David had some capital of his own when they died, and they wanted to provide for him in the most tax-efficient manner available. The capital in the family was all held by Gwen. Adrian, an undischarged bankrupt, was not liable to be free from that impediment for at least another 3 years. However, Gwen was not satisfied with the return that she was getting on her capital in the building society, where it was currently invested, and therefore sought Brian's advice on what she might do. Gwen was concerned that if she died, her money would go to Adrian, and that the money would then be lost to Adrian's creditors. Adrian had been in business on his own, and unfortunately that business had failed. Gwen, on the other hand, had been left a legacy by a wealthy aunt, and it was the proceeds of this legacy that they were now living on. All of Adrian's assets had been taken by the trustee in bankruptcy to discharge his debts to his creditors. All of the policies and pension policies had been taken and encashed or appropriated for the benefit of the creditors. Incidentally, is there anything that has been discussed that, had it been used, adopted for the life insurances, would have been protected from the trustees in bankruptcy? Just think back. What form of trust could have been used, adopted for the life insurances, that would have been protected from the trustee in bankruptcy? A Married Women's Property Act 1882 trust protects assets from creditors. But Adrian is already adjudged to be bankrupt, so it's of no use to him now. In normal circumstances, Brian might well have suggested that a single premium bond investment in Adrian's name could provide an income stream of, say, 5%, and as he, Adrian, was the most likely to predecease his wife, then perhaps some advantage could have been taken of the dead settler rule by having Gwen as a joint life assured under the policy, inheriting the policy under his will, and thereby gaining the tax advantage of the then current tax system. Had Brian done that, however, the trustee in bankruptcy, who had charge of all Adrian's assets, would immediately have seized on the bond, encashed it, and distributed it to Adrian's creditors. An investment in Adrian's name, therefore, was a non-starter. Brian also suggested that perhaps an offshore bond might be appropriate to Gwen's requirements. He pointed out that UK bonds were subject to internal tax on the funds, which is why the proceeds of the bond were distributed net of standard rate tax. Tax was deemed to be paid within the bond. Offshore bonds, on the other hand, did not carry an internal tax, and therefore incorporated what is usually termed a gross roll-up facility. The gross income or interest rolls up within the bond. If the proceeds of the bond were then distributed to a UK resident investor in normal circumstances, then those proceeds would be taxable. Offshore bonds do not require the same insurable interest requirements as policies issued under English legal requirements. That facility could also be useful. Offshore bonds do, however, still benefit from the facility that gave single premium whole life assurance investment bonds a 5% withdrawal facility. Under this facility, 5% of the original investment could be withdrawn every year for 20 years without recourse to a tax charge. It was, in effect, deemed to be the capital drawn down over that period. Any excess over the amount originally invested is further evidenced by the mechanism known as top slicing, which, when it is applied, effectively spreads the whole of the gain over the term of the policy up to the 20-year point and applies it in proportion to the years that the capital has been invested to each year for assessment purposes. It is only in the year of assessment that the normal income of the individual plus